I'm Nathan Rutherford, and welcome to Myth Madness. So far on the pod, I've mentioned the underworld a lot, and with a number of different names. I've talked about it as a prison for the Titans, a home for the dead, a kingdom of the god Hades, and now, the place where Persephone lives for a portion of every year. But I haven't really described the underworld to you. First off today, is kind of a geography lesson on the ancient Greek underworld. But get ready, like so many things in myth, these things are not always completely consistent. The underworld is usually called Hades, after its ruler, Hades, the god of the dead. The name comes from a longer Greek term used for the underworld, Eidos Domoisen, meaning the house of Hades. However, other names are linked with the underworld too, either the entire place or specific locations within. One of these names is Erebus, meaning darkness. It refers to the underworld as being a dark place, full of mist and gloom. Way back in the creation episodes, I first spoke of Erebus as being one of the beings born from the primeval chaos. It was one of the beings that doubled as a location. It seems that in addition to the gloom and mist, the underworld could be considered a watery place, or at least a place crisscrossed with water, as a consistent description of the underworld is its five rivers. How these rivers connected to each other is not clear. Sometimes it is said the rivers all converged together at a marsh in the center of the underworld, but the Greeks also gave differing accounts on which river flowed into another. The first, and most well-known, river is the Styx, the river of hatred. Like so many other physical locations in Greek myth, this river is also described as a person, or at least it has its own spirit. Styx, the person, is a nymph, and she was one of the first to side with Zeus in the Titanomachy, the war against the Titans. When Zeus, once he was king, started giving out responsibilities to his family and supporters, he decreed that the most sacred, unbreakable oaths would be sworn to her, to Styx. Hesiod actually describes how these oaths were sworn. According to him, the messenger of the gods Iris would go fetch a cup of water from the river Styx, and the god who was swearing the oath would take the cup and pour the water out on the floor. Hesiod also says that the nymph Styx lived in a large palace in the underworld, and the roof of this palace was supported by columns of silver. This Styx is usually described as a daughter of Oceanus and Tethys. This makes a lot of sense, as even the river Styx is described as flowing out of Oceanus. Remember, Oceanus is both a person, a titan, and a huge river that circles around the world. The water of the river Styx is very cold, and it seems to flow not horizontally, but vertically. Hesiod says that the river falls off a precipice, which is taken to mean off the edge of the world, and Homer calls the river steep dripping. The river is like a long waterfall. Now, the river Styx is probably most famous, though, for something else. It is said to be the river the dead have to sail on to get to the underworld. Specifically, dead souls are to be ferried on the boat of a being called Charon. Charon was a son of Erebus, but his boss was Hades. Hermes, who serves to guide the dead souls to the underworld, brings them to Charon, who then ferries them onto the next part of the underworld. But he does not do this for free. His price is a single obulus, a coin that was used in ancient Greece. For the ancient Greeks, when a person died, it was very important to place this coin in the mouth of the corpse before burial. If they did not, that soul would not have a coin to pay Charon. Now, the sources for this are Roman, and the Romans do have a lot to say about Charon ferrying souls over the Styx River. What's interesting, though, is this version of Charon may be a Roman, or at least a late period innovation. In archaic, classical, and even early Hellenistic Greece, it seems that Charon did not ferry souls over the Styx. Instead, the works of the poet Pindar, various Athenian plays, Plato, Callimachus, all say that Charon ferries souls through a different river of the underworld. And that river is called Acheron, and it is the river of pain. To make things a little more confusing, sometimes it wasn't considered a river. In some classical Greek plays, Acheron was considered a lake or swamp within the underworld. Usually, though, it's a river. Two other rivers of the underworld served as its tributaries. It had other tributaries as well, and a few Greek writers claimed that some of these flowed through real parts of the world. There is also a real river, called Acheron, that is in the northwest of Greece. The tributaries of Acheron that are underworld rivers, too, are, first, Cocytus, the River of Sorrow. The Odyssey mentions that Cocytus is a branch of the River Styx. The second river, Phlegethon, is the River of Fire, The Greek philosopher Plato described Phlegethon as coiling around the Earth and then flowing into the depths of Tartarus. Pretty cool description. I'd love to see a waterfall of lava going off the edge of the world. And finally, the fifth river is Lethe, the River of Forgetfulness. Dead souls drank water from this river. Drinking from the river caused them to forget the events of their lives. The Roman poet Ovid further elaborated on this river, and he said the river flowed through a cave that was home to Hypnos, the god of sleep. In addition to Lethe, though, one of the Greek mystery religions claimed that there was another body of water in the underworld called Mnemosyne, so sharing its name with the Titan goddess of memory, and that this body of water, according to the cult, would cause dead souls to retain their memories if they drank from it. Now, once past the rivers, dead souls came to the gates of the underworld. Next to these gates, there should be a big sign saying, "Beware of dog," because the gates are guarded by a huge three-headed dog, and this one is not named Fluffy. This dog is called Cerberus, and its job is twofold: to keep any still living mortals that get past the rivers from entering the underworld, and to keep any dead souls from getting back into the world of the living. Greek art sometimes shows Cerberus with his three heads, but often it just shows him with two, probably because it was easier to draw or paint a two-headed dog. What is interesting, though, is that in the written sources, the number of Cerberus's heads changes drastically. In fact, the earliest descriptions make Cerberus especially monstrous. In archaic Greece, Hesiod gives him 50 heads, while the poet Pindar says 100. Over time, for some reason, these heads decreased. By the time of Alexander the Great and the Roman Empire, even later, we get the standard three heads. The parents of our monster dog are, as expected, two more monsters. Cerberus's father is Typhon, a scary creature who has slipped into some of the earlier episodes, and his mother is a half-woman, half-snake named Echidna. Cerberus seems to have inherited some of the snake DNA from his parents. In art, he is shown with a snake tail and numerous little snake heads coming out of his body like tendrils, and many Greek and Roman writers refer to these snakes. Beyond Cerberus, there were different areas of the underworld. One of them was Elysium, sometimes called the Blessed Isles. Homer and Hesiod said it was located at the westernmost edge of the earth, on the far side of the world river Oceanus. This place was sometimes described as a plain or meadow, an island, or a series of islands. But regardless, it was considered a paradise. There were no storms or snow here, and like during the mythical Golden Age I talked about way back in episode 1, the ground in Elysium provides all the food its inhabitants need. So who got to stay in Elysium? Some heroes, people who lived righteous lives, and others specifically chosen by the gods. These people also had a king who ruled over them benevolently. In one version, this king is Rhadamanthus, who was the king of Crete when he was alive too, and he was supposed to have been a just, wise ruler. In the other tradition, though, the king of Elysium is none other than Cronos, the father of Zeus. Apparently, Zeus eventually let his father out of Tartarus and placed him in control here. But what happened to people who were not allowed to enter Elysium? Well, they entered another part of the underworld instead, typically called the Asphodel Meadows. This was a plain that the dead souls, or shades as they are called, kind of just crowded around for all eternity. Early in ancient Greek history, it seems like the whole underworld was thought of this way, but as the Greek conception of the underworld evolved over time, the meadows were thought to be the region for those who lived normal, unremarkable lives. Standing in a field sure seems like a particularly boring afterlife. And then there is Tartarus, very different from the paradise of Elysium and the sunless, windless plain of the Asphodel Meadows. Like Elysium, Tartarus is not exactly part of the underworld. It is instead described by Homer as a region as far below the underworld as the earth is from the sky. And we get a lovely description from Hesiod about how an anvil would fall 9 days from heaven to earth, and then a further 9 days to get to Tartarus. Tartarus itself, from almost the very beginning, is treated as the prison or garbage dump of the immortals. Cronos and Zeus both use it as a prison for their undesirables. Even though Hades is the king of the underworld, interestingly, it doesn't seem to have been Hades' job to judge all the incoming souls and determine where they would spend eternity. Even our archaic Greek poets, Homer, Hesiod, Pindar, and others, refer to three wise mortal kings, Minos, Rhadamanthes, and Aikos. Two of these men were actually brothers and also sons of Zeus. Minos and Rhadamanthes, as well as sometimes a third brother named Sarpedon, were the sons of Zeus and a mortal woman named Europa. Homer says that Minos held a golden scepter and sits in the house of Hades giving his judgments. The poet Pindar talks about Rhadamanthes, echoing what I've already said, that he stayed in Elysium and gave his judgments while sitting next to Cronos. The third man, Aeacus, was also a son of Zeus, but this time with a nymph named Aegina. The philosopher Plato said that Rhadamanthes judges the souls from Asia, Aeacus judges the souls from Europe, and Minos sits as their overseer. Plato even made a point of saying that Minos sits with a rod, just like how Homer said he sat with a golden staff. In addition to the mortal judges, there were several other immortal beings that inhabited the underworld. Nyx is the goddess of night. She is not one of the Olympians and instead is one of the oldest beings in the Greek myth universe. She is the sister of Gaia, being born from the primeval chaos space. She's also the sister and sexual partner of Erebus, which serves as a name for the underworld, but in this case is the personification of darkness. Hesiod says that Nyx has a home in Tartarus. She doesn't stay there all the time, though. When Hermera, the personification of day, enters Tartarus, Nyx leaves, presumably bringing night to the earth above. Like her sister Gaia, Nyx is the mother of multiple divine entities, and like their mother, many of these live in the underworld too. One of these is Hypnos, the god of sleep. It is from his name that we get the word hypnotize. Ovid says Hypnos lives in a cave from which the underworld river Lethe runs. Homer, however, does not put Hypnos in the underworld. He says Hypnos lives on the island of Lemnos. Maybe like his mother Nyx, Hypnos moves around, going from dank, dark hermit cave to bright, sunny seaside villa. Hypnos, though, has a tendency of getting on the bad side of Zeus. In several instances, he helps Hera's attempts to influence the lives of mortals by putting Zeus to sleep. When Zeus awakes and realizes the trick, he becomes angry, but Hypnos always hides with his mother Nyx. This saves him, as it seems even the king of the gods fears crossing one of the oldest and presumably incredibly powerful immortals in existence. Another son of Nyx is Thanatos, which means death. Hesiod and Homer both agree that Thanatos is the twin brother of Hypnos. Both brothers were depicted as having wings, and they traveled across the world. But while Hypnos is kind, delivering restful sleep to humans, Thanatos is described as cold, pitiless, and without mercy. He is a guide to the underworld, like the god Hermes, but once Thanatos grabs hold of you, he never lets go. Nyx also had a whole number of daughters that were linked to death too. There were the Caries, who are linked to violent deaths, and they were basically scary vampire women. The Caries were imagined as having sharp teeth and claws, and they would stalk through battlefields or fly over top fighting armies to find injured dying men. Then, the Caries would grab them close, drink their blood, and send their souls down to the underworld. The Erinyes, or the Furies, were sometimes daughters of Nyx, and sometimes born from the blood of Uranos, after his son Cronos chopped off his genitals. The Erinyes were very old figures in Greek myth. The word Erinu appears in tablets of Mycenaean Greek. In the myths, they are typically shown as three goddesses, and they are responsible for vengeance and retribution. If a human does a crime against Zeus's natural order, say, sons killing mothers, for example, they're soon going to find the Erinyes on their tail, hunting them down. You'd see them coming, too. In Greek and Roman art, they are ugly, hairy women with wings and snakes slithering all over them. When the Erinyes weren't chasing mankind's greatest jerks, they spent their time in the world below, working for Hades and Persephone. Their job, to torture the souls of those so bad, the gods decreed they spend eternity in Tartarus. Then we come to the Morae, the three fate goddesses. Like the Erinyes, their parentage is not consistent across different Greek sources, and kind of annoyingly, sometimes the same source, too. At first, Hesiod's Theogony says that they are the daughters of Nyx, and then a couple hundred lines later in the exact same poem says that they were the children of Zeus and Themis. The names of these three goddesses are Clotho, meaning spinner, Lachesis, drawer of lots, and Atropos, unturning. The Morae were weavers and spinners of thread. Each life had a dedicated thread, and the Morae started spinning it at birth and cut the threads at death. They literally weave the destiny of every living thing out of this thread. There are plenty of examples of the Morae appearing at the birth of various heroes and even gods to declare something about them, often as a vague prophecy. The Morae did all this weaving in the underworld. Finally, we come to the ruler of the underworld, Hades. In the last two episodes, I've mostly focused on the Homeric hymn to Demeter, the fullest telling of the story of how Persephone was abducted and brought to the underworld to be its queen. That same hymn references the typical story of how Hades came to be there too. It says it was his third share. So, here we have it again. When the three sons of Cronos decided to split the universe in three, Zeus received the heavens, Poseidon the sea, and Hades became king of the underworld. This was not a bad position for Hades. Ruling over the dead brought with it a lot of responsibility, and also a lot of honor. Hades was content with his rule of the underworld, and largely stayed within it. He rarely went above ground, except of course to kidnap Persephone, and he also very rarely went to Olympus. In fact, in several instances, he doesn't even seem to particularly care what goes on above ground, and is rarely sucked into the schemes between Olympians. The Greeks respected Hades, but that respect, because he was so closely related to death, brought with it a lot of fear, too. This is why the Greeks used more than one name for the god of the dead. The name Hades sometimes also varied as Aedes, Aeda, Eidos, and Aidonius, all of which mean unseen, or the unseen one. Around the 5th century BC, the Greeks also began using Pluton, which means wealthy. This is also where the Roman name for Hades, Pluto, comes from. The philosopher Plato says that the name Pluton was actually the name people preferred to use, as the name Hades was more, I guess, powerful. Since so many valuable things like metals and so on came from below ground, Hades was thought to be extremely rich. And of course, if he had all of Charon's gold coins collected from all those dead souls, he'd have a small fortune alone. Polysemantor, which means the ruler of many, as in all the dead spirits, was another name linked to Hades. Because Hades was said to rule over the underworld, just like how Zeus ruled over Olympus way above, Hades was sometimes also called Zeus Katakathonius, or Zeus of the underworld. And like Zeus, Hades is imagined as being a divine version of a human king, only in the underworld. He has a palace, subjects, the dead, and riches. Apollodorus says that Hades also had his own herds of oxen in the underworld. This description likely echoes at least one very early Greek conception of the afterlife, where the underworld is a dark but vast earth-like pasture land ruled by a king Hades in a palace with fields of oxen. As the Greek myths evolved over the centuries, the different regions and the judges were incorporated at different times. Hades is often shown with a key to the gates of the underworld and a powerful bident. A bident is like a trident, but instead of three prongs at the end, there are only two. Sometimes Hades also holds a cornucopia due to his richness. But the object most famously linked with him is the helmet of Hades. According to Apollodorus's library, written in the 1st century AD, the helmet was created by the Cyclopses during the war between the Olympians and the Titans, and the helmet was made for Hades, and allowed him to turn invisible, while the Cyclopses made Poseidon his trident, and the lightning bolt for Zeus. Apollodorus's library is a late work, and what is interesting is that it is only Apollodorus that directly links the helmet to Hades, and there are also no myths that we know of that actually have him wearing it. Instead, in early works, we only ever have Athena or Hermes use it to turn invisible. Athena wears it at one point during the Trojan War, when she decides to help the Greeks in the war. Hermes wears it on another occasion when he fights a monster, and a Greek mortal hero named Perseus uses it to kill the monstrous snake woman Medusa, and it was Athena who gave it to him, not Hades. So, it's possible that this helmet of Hades was not originally thought to belong exclusively to the god of death. To get what I mean, let's talk about the ancient Greek word for the helmet, Eidos Kainin, which literally translates to dog skin of Hades. Dog skin here refers to a type of hat. So the Eidos Kainin is not really a helmet. It's more like a fur cap, the fur cap of Hades. And what's more, earlier in the episode, I mentioned that the name Hades actually means unseen, or the unseen one, or the invisible one. For that reason, Eidos Kainin could be also translated to cap of invisibility, and this is a very common translation used by scholars and seems to be a more accurate representation of the cap in the myths with Athena, Hermes, and Perseus. So why the link with Hades the god? Perhaps the Greeks envisioned that Hades did possess it, but instead of using it, he kept it as a curiosity on the mantle above his fireplace, and lent it out to gods and goddesses in need of it. Maybe there's even a myth that's lost of him using it to fight the Titans. But I think, frankly, the Greeks liked a good pun. Originally, the so-called helmet was more of a general cap of invisibility that some of the gods, Athena mostly, since she is the main benefactor of human heroes, used it in their adventures. But because Hades also means the invisible one, the cap of invisibility, Eidos Kynein, maybe became Eidos Kynein, the cap of the invisible one. And the tradition shifted over time into Helmet of Hades. That anyway is my theory. Since Hades does not seem particularly interested in the world above, he rarely features in the myths about different Greek heroes. He does appear in a few cases, though, when those heroes try to come to the underworld. In one example, we have the friends Pirithous and Theseus. Theseus is a pretty famous Greek hero, so I will have a whole bunch to say about him at some point in the future when I cover the more standard Greek heroes. But for now, let's focus on this adventure with Pirithous. One day, these two men made a pact to find each other wives, but not in a I'll be your wingman at the bar kind of pact. These two decided that they would help each other kidnap women to make their brides. First, they kidnap a 12-year-old girl, disturbing, who just so happens to be the half-human daughter of Zeus, and they kidnap her for Theseus. Then it's Pirithous' turn. He wants to go to the underworld and kidnap the queen of the dead, Persephone herself. According to the historian Diodorus of Sicily's version of this myth, Theseus at first tried to persuade Pirithous to pick someone else to kidnap. But Pirithous insisted, and because they had both sworn oaths in their bride kidnapping pact, Theseus was duty-bound to accompany him. So they went to the underworld. It's not clear how they got there, but once they did, Hades and Persephone immediately knew why they were there. It's hard to trick a god, after all. But Hades pretended to welcome them to his palace and had Pirithous and Theseus sit themselves down on a throne or bench to rest. The problem was, in the account of Pseudo-Apollodorus, this was no ordinary chair. It was actually the magical throne of forgetfulness. Anyone who sat on it would instantly become stuck. And the two friends' bodies grew into the bench itself, and serpent coils sprang out of it, tied them to it, and held them. There are slightly different accounts of this. Diodorus says that they were only put in chains. Other later Roman sources say that they were punished by the Furies. I personally like the idea that they grew into the chair and got stuck. But regardless, for trying to kidnap Persephone, Pirithous and Theseus became trapped and tortured in the underworld. Theseus, for his part, was eventually rescued by a different hero, but Pirithous was not so lucky, and he remained in the underworld until the end of time. Since I started this little 3-episode segment about Persephone, it only seems right to go back to Persephone here with something I noticed about the myth about Pirithous and Theseus, and it's this. The entire myth hinges on Persephone's presence in the underworld. If Persephone wasn't queen of the underworld, the heroes wouldn't have gone there to kidnap her. In fact, it almost seems that sometimes in the Greek myths, Persephone is very much the queen of the underworld, and Hades is much more of her Prince Philip, her royal consort. As I've even mentioned today, Hades doesn't even really do much in the underworld. Cerberus guards it, Thanatos brings the dead, and Minos and the other judges judge them. Hades is kind of a chairman of the board. He oversees, he occasionally meets heroes, but he doesn't really concern himself with the day-to-day, and he never leaves. In contrast to this, though, I invite you to take a look at Homer's poem The Odyssey that tells the adventures of the hero Theseus. At one point, Odysseus actually uses magic to go to visit dead souls. And who are we explicitly told sends souls to him? Not Hades. Instead, it's our CEO of Underworld Inc., who in the poem is called Dread Persephone. So it seems Persephone was not just a demure wife of Hades. In fact, a more active role for Persephone may have been the dominant tradition in some parts of Greece. It even sometimes shows up in art. Remember in episode 14 I said Persephone had cults across the Greek world? Well, one of those cults was located at the Greek colony of Locris, in Italy, and archaeologists have found some very interesting stuff there. They found numerous tablets stamped with images of Persephone's myths, and some of them show Hades and Persephone together, but others clearly show Persephone sitting on a throne, looking majestic, without her spouse in sight. Certainly food for thought. And that's all for today. Next time on the pod, I will pick up the tour of Greek gods and goddesses with Aphrodite, so stay tuned. If you've enjoyed these last 3 episodes on Persephone, Demeter, and Hades, you can review the pod on your favorite streaming platform, or leave me a comment on the pod website. at www.mythmadness.com. Thank you for listening.